Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. This is episode number 29. I'm Karen, and I'm joined once again by my co-host, Kristen.
Hello, everyone. I have nothing witty to say.
That was a slightly shorter pause than last week.
Yes.
But
we'll get better.
So,
you know, being a podcaster.
We've got Sleepy Kristen once again.
Yeah.
It's early in the morning.
Mornings are not my forte.
Yeah. We'll get through it. You can contact us at Prophecy Podcast on Twitter, at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Tumblr, Instagram, and Facebook, and Prophecy Radio Podcast at gmail.com. We've got a cool episode ahead of us. We're talking about the Adam Project today because Walker Scobell is our Percy Jackson. That will never not make me smile, being able to say that. But before we get into the movie, we've got actually quite a few bits of news here to talk about. Some really cool stuff happening. So, of course, we know it was hashtag Sea of Monsters week this past week. It's coming to a close. There was some really cool stuff shared. We're recording this on Friday, and Fan Art Fridays might be my favorite. Don't tell the other days of the week, because I'm not an artist. Like, I cannot create the things that other people can create.
Same.
And so whenever I see some awesome renditions, like their versions of how they see the characters in their heads and stuff like that, it just always impresses me.
Yeah.
I love it so much. Next week is hashtag Titans Curse Week, though, and I feel like we're ready for that one.
Yeah, for sure.
We've got, you know, we're almost done with the book, actually. Only a couple more chapters, yeah. And I feel like everything's so fresh. And I'm really excited about all of that. So
definitely.
Pretty cool. A lot of people have been hilarious on Twitter posting pictures of pine trees and going, my ideal Talia casting.
Talia. She's never going to get away from the tree jokes. Never, ever, ever. So many tree jokes.
Yeah. Okay, well, April 19th was apparently the ideal day for book releases, because we had quite a few within our little group here. First and foremost, Arusha and the End of Time graphic novel by Roshni Chokshi, adapted by Joe Caramagna and illustrated by Anu Chuhan, was released, and that's pretty exciting, especially if you like graphic novels or you know somebody young who isn't that great of a reader, but, like, you know, still enjoys those stories. Graphic novels, great present for kids mm-hmm. who fight you on reading. Mm-hmm. Also, just like a collector's thing. We don't have a copy. I kind of want to get one just to say I have it.
I'm definitely interested in looking into this. I thought it had an ebook release, but when I went looking for it to pre-order it, I couldn't find the pre-order for the ebook, so I'm interested to see if it has come out.
Right, yeah.
So I'll be checking that out later.
Yeah, good call. And while we're here talking about Arusha, I figured that I would mention Reed Riordan put up an article about Jambavan, the Bear King. Did you meet him in the first book?
It sounds familiar, but I don't remember.
I feel like he had one of the big chairs.
That might have been.
Yeah. He's a lot more important in the fifth book, so I think it's pretty interesting that, you know, he kind of comes back in a bigger role. But yeah. I like the illustration that they used for the article. It was kind of cute. One of the other books that was released on April 19th was Fevered Star by Rebecca Roanhorse. This is the second Between Earth and Sky book, and we had talked about this previously on our Rick Riordan Presents Roundup episode, and I really, really want to read this series. It sounds so good, and I have too many books to read right now. I literally cannot fit it in, but oh man, do I want to read this. A book you want to read, though,
yes,
is Flirting with Fate by J.C. Cervantes, also out on April 19th. This is a YA romance?
I believe so, yes.
Okay.
And it looks really cute, and I got it from my library, an ebook, so I'm interested to check it out.
Yeah. When you do read that, you have to give us a little update, a little mini review on it.
For sure.
And This is not a book release, but we did get some news this past week. We had been talking to Roshni during our interview, and she had mentioned she had an announcement come mid-April, and she was not a liar. She did have an announcement. not that we suspected she was lying, but she has a new book coming out, Winter 2023, called The Last Tale of the Flower Bride, which is just a creepy, cool kind of title. I really like it. It's her adult debut, so that's kind of exciting. And the little pitch here says, a fairy tale-laden gothic novel about a marriage that slowly unravels as a husband picks at the threads of a dangerous secret his wife is keeping. Now, anytime you put the word gothic in a description about a book, Karen's going to pick it up and read it.
It's true.
Even if Roshni hadn't written this, which is already like, yes, I'm going to read it, but
Karen likes the spooky things.
I do.
It's not my forte. I usually.
Yeah.
But I mean, we'll have to see. I'll see.
Yeah. It sounds pretty exciting, though. So if you're into that, keep your eye out. I'm sure pre-orders will be going up eventually. I mean, this was just announced. And I think it's meant to be a duology. Don't quote me on that. I didn't write that part down. But I feel like it was a two-book deal. Although, that doesn't necessarily mean duology, right? Like, two-book deals can just be like, you have to write two books for us.
That's a good question, actually. Because I don't think it necessarily means she won't get any more than that, but at least she's, like, guaranteed at least the two books or something.
Well, I was thinking they don't even have to be, like, in a series together, right? It could be, like, two standalone novels.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So we'll just have... Maybe it's not a duology. Don't quote me.
You never know. But we should get a second book from her about something.
Yes, which is exciting. Right? Always.
Yay.
Rick put up a video. Actually, Rick was all over the place this week, which was pretty cool. Put up a video about Daughter of the Deep, basically thanking everybody for 25 straight weeks on the New York Times bestsellers list. Very exciting. Always cool when that happens.
Oh, yeah.
And I really like when he was like, with your help, you got to do this. And I was like, oh, that's nice. He loves us. He also mentioned that he and Aditi Brennan-Kapil have started the screenplay for the movie, the live-action movie for Disney+, which we kind of knew was coming, but, like, it was nice just to hear him say it again.
Yeah.
And we also got a little bit of an update on the King Chronicles / Solangelo book. I mean, not really, but Becky tweeted about this quiz that came out. And she was like, super glad Chris posted this quiz because it also serves as a reminder to tell you all that our team is still working hard on our Netflix King Chronicles movie script. Rick is taking a pause from the Mark Ashiro Nico book in order to make Red Pyramid script notes today. So it was just, you know, mini update, but I appreciate it all the same.
I'm not gonna lie, when I read that the first time, I like was in the middle of the sentence and she said he's taking a pause and I was like and she's like for the day and I was like oh, don't do that to me, Becky. It might only be, like, what, 200 characters or something? Yeah. But I had a whole roller coaster ride go on in those 200 characters, man.
Your heart just stopped.
I was like, no, he can't pause. I was like, oh, for today. He can pause for a day again.
Rick, you're never allowed to take breaks, ever.
No days off.
Think of Kristen's heart. Oh, man.
Take the days off. Take whatever days you need.
Please rest. Don't get burnt out because then that's bad. When you get burnt out, then you're out of commission for a while.
Do not worry about me. I will be fine.
Yeah. She'll soldier on.
Exactly.
But yes, Rick is everywhere this week, and he had an interview with Daniel Jose Older, whose book Ballad and Dagger comes out May 3rd. And they were basically talking about how personal this book is for Daniel and how he drew from his life experience to write it. And this was the first time I actually really saw him, like, on camera speaking. And he's, like, super smiley guy. And he was really just talking about being an EMT and wanting to be a musician and transitioning into writing. And it was really funny. And I think the two of them have really good chemistry. And they were both excited to be there. Also, fun fact that I learned, Leigh Bardugo helped him come up with the title Ballad and Dagger, because apparently he was really struggling with it.
Aww.
Yeah, and they're friends, and he was bouncing ideas off of her, and she was like, Ballad and Dagger, that's the title. And he was like, oh, that's awesome, thank you. And so it's just
that's
like,
too cute.
She was apparently tired of, you know, going back and forth with him and just chose the title.
That's the one. Just yeah. Do it right now.
Well, it's funny because the other day on Twitter, I noticed that I think he had finished his edits on the second Ballad and Dagger book. And Steph Lurie, the Rick Riordan Presents, like, editor, was basically like, good, now choose a title. So this must be a thing for him. It's like he's not good at titles or something.
Titles
so.
Are difficult.
Yeah, they are difficult. Well, Ballad and Dagger is an awesome title. Thank
it
you,
is.
Leigh Bardugo.
It is a very good
So title. Hopefully the second one will be great as well. Maybe he'll hit her up again and have
right.
her choose the second one too.
Like, okay, so what do you think about this one?
Yeah.
What do you think? Let's go through all of the options.
Okay, so in true, you know, Prophecy Radio form, as soon as we put out our last episode, before we even put out our last episode, I think it was right after we recorded it, Rick put out another blog post. I feel like we're always scrambling to catch up. But it happens. It's cool. Gives us something else to talk about this week. So on April 16th, he posted another blog post. I'm not going to read all of it, but it is like most of it because there was some good information in there.
Okay.
First thing he says is, just a gentle reminder, I am no longer on social media. Ashley does a great job posting and retweeting fun content. Becky keeps me up to date about how things are going in general, but it would be inaccurate to say Rick posted this or Rick said that or Rick saw me on whatever platform because I'm not there. Especially with the intense interest in this TV show, it's just been better for my focus and mental well-being to stay away from the apps for the past year and a half. First and foremost, I totally agree with that. Social media is hard. Our social media is hard enough. I'm always yeah. thinking about it. When one of our posts go like a little viral, I can't stop checking Twitter and seeing what people are saying. So if this makes him, you know, more productive, if it makes him more relaxed, totally fine with him not being on social.
Yeah, I mean, I get it, especially with the show. And all of the...
He's so
I mean, he's
busy.
Got so much going on that for people to also be constantly, like, throwing questions at him and him wanting to answer because he's Rick, and I can see that being, like, really, like, just a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's cool that he's got Ashley doing their social, and then Becky is on... pretty regularly, is on, you know, at least Twitter. I don't know. It's where I see her most.
Yeah.
And it just, there's enough reach that you feel like you still have a connection to Rick, even though he's not on social media anymore.
I mean, he endorses everything that
right,
they're
exactly,
saying. They
exactly.
talk about it. So.
But yeah, it's probably better for him to just kind of stay in his little bubble and work on the show and get all of his, you know, projects done and not worry about us all being like, Rick, give us all the answers.
Yeah.
Tell us all the things. Please. Thanks. Bye.
Yeah. I also wanted to bring this up because I've definitely said like, oh, Rick tweeted this. I know that it's Ashley. And I assume that most people at this point know it's Ashley.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've kind of perpetrated this idea that, you know, Rick said this on Twitter. I would hope, you know, even if that does come out of our mouths, we know it's Ashley, and I hope everybody else knows that it's Ashley, too.
Yeah, like, because it's, you know, Rick's name on the account, and because, you know, he's been on social media for so long, it's so easy to just kind of be like, oh, yeah, Rick retweeted us, you know, whatever. It's not, it's his account. It's not him anymore, but it is still his account, and it's Ashley, you know, trying to help promote people and things like that. So when we say Rick did something, it's not, we know it's not Rick.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think that paragraph was directed at us
no.
either. But I just wanted everyone to know that
we are not that.
We are not that important. Not even a little bit.
We like to dream.
Yeah. Okay, so the next thing that he says, he was like, I know there's a question on everybody's mind, and it's, when are we announcing Annabeth and Grover, and can it be right now? Answer, soon. And no, it cannot be right now. As I said before, I think we're very close to having everything wrapped up for our main trio, but there are numerous levels of approvals to get and deals to close before we can announce anything. Things are starting to move into high gear, though, since we begin filming in June, so we are probably talking weeks, not months, before we can share more news. Very exciting. We're hoping that, you know, comes to fruition sooner rather than later, but hey, we're June's not that far away.
I was gonna say, but by the time shooting begins, I will say definitely, because I'm throwing myself out on a limb here, we will definitely know who the main trio is.
Oh, we have to, yeah.
We will probably know who Sally and maybe even Poseidon is. We'll know who Chiron is. Those
Mr.
sorts of
D,
characters. Yeah.
Grover, yeah.
The
yeah.
ones that are, like, major, that are going to be recurring, that are going to, you know, basically be signing on for 5 years of this. Because we're getting 5 seasons.
Yes, obviously.
Dang it. You know, I think we will know all of those before June. And then as the show, you know, as they film and as people come on set, so, like, you know, as we meet Poseidon for the first time and things like that, we'll start to get dribblings of those characters, too. Uh-huh. So it'll be, oh, so-and-so, you know, like, someone will see them on set, and then the next day there'll be an announcement that so-and-so is playing this. It happens, like, every year with new shows, and, like, yeah. when... Like, I'm a big Nancy Drew and Legacies fan, so, like, every time a new character shows up on those shows, like, they'll show up on set first, and then, like, the next day, you'll get an announcement that they're playing this such-and-such character. It happens.
Yeah. Now, the big chunk, the meat of this blog post is what I really wanted to talk about. He says, are we going to make Walker dye his hair black? Answer, we have had zero conversations about this. Personally, I think this is a non-issue. For me, finding the right actors has never been about hair color, eye color, skin color, or any other single physical trait, even if they were described a certain way in the books. As many of you know, I flubbed such details myself several times in the series. Talia's eyes changed from green to blue. Oops, Annabeth's hair was curly, and then it was straight. Nico was described as olive-skinned, then later as pale. Blackjack even changed from a mare to a stallion over the course of 2 books. Well, not sure what happened there, but too late now. If I may invoke the movies that shall not be watched, I know a lot of you care deeply and were unhappy when Annabeth turned out to be a brunette rather than blonde, but for me, that was never the main issue. What mattered were that those actors, as talented and wonderful as they are, were way too old for the parts as I wrote them, and their age was central to the plot. What I want to see are age-appropriate actors who can embody the personality of the characters, nail their voices and their sense of humor, and make you believe, yes, that is Percy, that is Grover, that is Annabeth, even if they're not exactly how the characters were described physically in the books. Again, that's just my personal opinion and my approach. So blonde Percy, hey, why not? In my opinion, Walker is awesome just as he is. He is perfect for the role. The same will be true for our other characters when I can announce them. I feel kind of vindicated because we talked about this last week about not really caring if Annabeth is blonde, not really caring, like, you know, her race, her ethnicity, like, whoever is best for the role, we're going to be happy with them in the role. So I feel pretty cool that Rick is coming at this at the same way that we are. I know some people online are still kind of upset about this. They want to see Percy the way that they envisioned him in their heads, and that's with black hair, and they want to see Annabeth the same way. And I totally get that. It's fine to feel that way. I hope, though, that that doesn't ruin it for anybody. Like, I get, again, wanting to see what you envisioned in your head, but these kids are being cast for their personalities, for the ability to portray these characters, and I want them to nail those details more than anything else.
Yeah, and I mean, who knows what's going on, you know, I say behind the scenes, even, you know, things that Rick, conversations Rick may not be quite privy to yet, like maybe costuming's talking about, you know, him dyeing his hair, or maybe they're considering a wig, or maybe they're considering something else. You never know. Because, again, there's a lot of moving parts on a movie set, any movie or TV set. So it's okay if he's blonde. It does not change. He's still Percy. It's not a big deal. But I get that, like, when you read a book, you kind of get attached to certain traits like that. Like, you know, you picture Percy as a little dark-haired miscreant running around, causing all kinds of trouble and being adorable and, you know, Percy-like. I get that, because I can kind of be that way sometimes, and it's okay to, like, want that. It's okay to be like, oh, but I kind of want it to be exactly like the book. Mm-hmm. I get it. But ultimately, as long as the actors are bringing the characters we love faithfully to the screen, that's what we have to, like, hold on to.
And on that note, I feel a little attached to Annabeth being blonde, just because it fights the stereotype that, you know, blondes are stupid and they're bimbos, and kind of like the whole Buffy thing, is she was this tiny little blonde white girl, and yet she could beat the crap out of, like, everybody, and that was, you know, that was the joke, that was the pitch. And I feel like Annabeth being a daughter of Athena, being extremely intelligent and strategical, that's a word, right? Tactical?
Strategic.
Tactical.
Yeah.
I might have combined the two.
Whatever.
Her being that way and being blonde, I feel like, was kind of the point.
Yeah.
So I get that. Like, I, you know, I do want Annabeth to be blonde, but it's not going to ruin it for me if she's not.
Right.
That's totally fine.
Right.
Whatever happens, happens. I'm just excited about this show. And speaking of, the last part of the post that I wanted to talk about says, "This will be The Lightning Thief, the story you know and love, but with added depth and layers of nuance that many of you have been yearning to know about, judging from the fan letters I've received over the past 15 years." And I just thought that was a sweet little note at the end. Gets me excited for what they're going to be adding to it. And just the fact that, like, he's been reading fan letters for that long. He knows what people want. He knows what people care about. And as an executive producer, he's going to bring that to the table when they're making this show. And that's just super exciting to me.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
Okay. Speaking of Percy Jackson, speaking of Walker and his floppy hair, let's talk about The Adam Project. We really wanted, one, to rewatch this movie because it was a great movie.
Right, it's good.
And two, I think that there are hints of Percy in his performance in this movie. So we really wanted to talk about that aspect of it most. But before we get to that, I wanted to know first your brief feelings about the movie, whether you liked it, I know you did, and your second watch of it, you know, how did you feel about it? Did anything change? Do you love it even more now?
Go. Yeah, no, this movie is a lot of fun. My first watch, I had a very strong appreciation for the fact that it was a time travel movie that didn't get so mired down in the science of time travel that it became really hard to follow and understand and, you know, play around in. I've watched a lot of time travel movies and TV shows, and, I mean, I think Marvel, with all of the stuff that went on in Endgame, definitely, even if you haven't watched a ton of time travel stuff, you definitely have probably seen that. So we've all been exposed to it, and it can get kind of heavy and hard to understand, and you can get a little bit in your head trying to figure out how one person on one timeline can affect somebody on another timeline and this and that. And it can kind of ruin the fun of a time travel movie sometimes.
Yeah.
And I really, really appreciated that The Adam Project was able to keep it so small, to keep the impact of time travel to this family and not have it be this ginormous thing that everyone on the planet is going to be killed because so-and-so has stepped back in time and all of this stuff. Like, it's a very intimate, small little movie about, you know, how time travel kind of came to be in this world, and someone's corrupted it, and, you know, all of that. I love that they were able to make this movie without it getting too big for itself and without trying to make the world bigger and trying to do this. And it just, it was really lovely.
Yeah.
So.
And I even, like, they even talk about that in the movie, how they explain how people are affected in the future and all that kind of stuff. And I even thought that explanation was very simple and very easy to follow and made sense and everything. So I totally agree. Did your feelings change at all when you watched it again?
No, I think, honestly, it just became an even greater appreciation for that, because it was like, wow, yeah, they really were able to, you know, to keep it fun and light and just interesting rather than complicated. Mm-hmm. And I really like that.
I also loved this movie. It was so good. The first time I watched it, I was watching it with my boyfriend, and he's a little bit more of a cynic than I am. And I don't think he disliked it. I think he thought it was good, but I was laughing a bunch, and he was sort of just like, you know, there. And then the second time I watched it, I was on the phone with my friends, and they were laughing their heads off, and I feel like I got, like, even more into the comedy aspect of it. Like, there were some lines that still made me laugh out loud. Like, it's a very funny movie. And half of those lines were Ryan Reynolds, as, you know, they're gonna be.
Yeah.
And half of them were walkers. Like, he is so funny. He has such great comedic timing. And I completely agree. I think the movie is a lot of fun. Also very emotional. Like, I cried the second time, especially. I think I probably cried the first time. I cry all the time. But there are some moments that are really heavy, and then you kind of bounce back to the comedy. It's just a really well-balanced movie, full of action and adventure and fun stuff. And I really liked the ending, too. And, yeah, I thought it was so good.
Oh, yeah.
I would watch it again.
I mean, I probably will at some point. Yeah,
I think it's going to be one of those movies where you just, like, throw it on to just have, you know, something funny on in the background, something you've seen before that you know you're going to enjoy.
I'm also a big fan of this Ryan Reynolds-Sean Levy pairing. They made Free Guy together, and they were
also a great movie.
Right, and they were involved in this, and I know they're working on the next Deadpool movie together, too. Mm. So I really love what they bring out in each other. Like, Ryan Reynolds, I feel like, is having the most fun he's had in the last few years, like, between Deadpool and some of the stuff. Like, I feel like he's just having a freaking blast making all these crazy movies. And I think Sean Levy is kind of a part of that, because I've always liked his stuff. I've liked how he makes movies and how they come across. And so I'm hoping that this trio of movies is not the end of their working together. Like, I really hope that down the line they continue to find projects they're both passionate about, because they're a good pair.
And those movies have been pretty successful. Like, people love Free Guy. People love this movie. It was trending on Netflix for a while, and I feel like it even got a bump when Walker was announced.
It was back in the top 10 for the week when we watched it, which was even, you know, a week after Walker was announced. So,
Yeah, so good for everyone involved. And there are some great names in this movie, too, and that was all very cool. Okay, so we wanted to talk about our favorite Walker Scobell scenes or lines from the movie. And honestly, there were so many. Like, he had some really great deliveries in this movie, but I tried to keep in mind the ones that felt like Percy Jackson to me. And the first scene for me was when he goes out into the woods with a flashlight and hawking the dog. And there's just something about him running through the forest that reminds me of Percy. Like, even the way the camera moves, it, like, pans overhead and you get a shot of him just running through the trees. I felt like that could be a shot from the show. He just needed a sword instead of a flashlight. And watching it the second time around, I was like, wow, like, there's probably going to be a scene similar to that in the show, him in the forest, you know, during Capture the Flag or whatever. And I got all excited all over again.
Yeah, no, I definitely can see it for sure. I had some thoughts about stuff like that, too, where I was like, oh, this, yeah, like, that could be, I could see that working, you know, like, he did this in this fight sequence. Well, that could work in in the Percy show, too. Like, they could totally... Yeah. Like, you know, you get kind of excited.
Yeah.
Okay, so my first one was right at the start of the movie. And it's when Adam Walker... Walker's Adam, I guess, is the best way to do that. Because there are a couple Adams. Walker's Adam is, like, running through the school, being chased by a bully. And the bully, like, catches up to him and has him pinned against the wall. And even... when he's facing down this bully and has this guy in his face, like, about to pummel him, he goes, "Who talks like that? Did you order, like, a bully starter kit on Amazon or something?" And it's just something about this line in this moment after he's just been, you know, running around the school. Like, even when he knows he should run and be afraid, he can't help but use his mouth as a potential weapon. And I feel like that has some Percy in it, man. Yeah. Like, Percy's not necessarily the... He's not the think-first-act-later guy, but he's also not an act-first-think-later guy either. Like, he falls in between, where he thinks a little, and then sometimes he's just like, ah, forget thinking. I'm just gonna do it.
Yeah.
And then sometimes he thinks it through all the way, and he never, you know, doesn't act at all. And I can definitely see that as one of the Ares scenes, and just them... going at it, and Percy, like, trading snaps back at him. A line very similar to this, or, you know, something. I can totally see it. So, that's why this is one of my first ones.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that, because basically every time Adam got beat up, I couldn't help but think about his fights with Clarice, all the hits he'll be taking from the various monsters. I think Walker is a great physical actor. He really, like, convinces you that he's getting punched, and he just rolls with the punches, that pun was not intended, very well. And I think he's going to do an awesome job with all of the fight scenes. And I completely agree with you that his mouth is going to get him in trouble, especially with Ares. And I think those scenes in particular are going to be very, very good. I think he's going to play up on that very well. I mean, I don't really want to see Percy getting beat up all the time, but I think that Walker's going to make it both very convincing and funny, and especially when he's going toe-to-toe with Clarice, it's going to be great.
Oh, yeah. I agree. Another one was the scene with Adam and his mom. There's a scene where she goes on a date, and she comes home, and the date knocks on the door because she left a scarf behind or something. And she answers the door, but Adam is standing, like, right behind her, and he's really snarky and snippy with his mom's date.
Mouth mullet.
The mouth mullet.
Oh, yeah. The you mouth could just mullet. Say goatee.
Right, exactly. But it reminded me a little bit of Percy being skeptical of Paul Blofus and maybe not having time to make snarky quips at him because he was talking through an Iris message and Sally is not ready to have that conversation with Paul Blofus. But it reminded me at the beginning of Sea of Monsters of, you know, Percy being a little overprotective and, you know, worrying a little about his mom and this new guy. And he's not necessarily trying to sabotage her or anything yet, but, you know, it could get that far because, you know, he has a very brief conversation and then has to be off to go questing and all that stuff. So it just reminded me of that a little bit, and in that Percy-Sally dynamic is going to be really important to the show, and seeing a bit of Walker doing that with Jennifer Garner gave me a little taste of that, and I think he's going to be great.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think that their dynamic in the movie is a little colder, a little more sarcastic because of all the stuff that they're going through, I can still see the heart of that relationship, and to have, especially near the end, you can really see him being affectionate with his mom, and I cannot wait to see that. I mean, we all love Sally so much,
okay.
And I can't wait to see who they cast in that role, Melissa Ponzio, and...
We don't have any first choice picks or anything.
No, and I really feel like he's going to do such a great job being little Percy Jackson, you know, who loves his mom and hates Gabe. And, you know, like that his sarcasm with Gabe is going to be brilliant.
On point. Yes.
It's going to be amazing. One of the other parts that I wanted to talk about was Adam and Maya Sorian at the end. And Maya Sorian, which we did not realize at first, you know, she's, what's her real name? Catherine Keener.
Yes.
She plays Sally in the movies, so that was kind of a interesting little interconnection there. But Adam and Maya Sorian at the end reminds me a bit of the Ares standoff. I mean, you know, she literally puts a gun to the kid's head, which Ares has a gun. I don't think he ever like locks his arm around Percy and holds him at gunpoint, yeah. But it's close enough to it. And I just think the way that Walker gets out of that situation is not wholly unlike how he deals with Ares at the end, and just him going toe to toe with an adult who's scary, who's got a gun. It kind of brought all that to mind, and I was like, okay, this could work. And I'm still curious to see if they use a gun in the show versus something else, but I think that this shows, you know, it can work without being too scary.
Yeah, and because of the mist, I'm really intrigued as to how they're gonna have all of that working.
Yeah,
with the weapons being non-weapons, like, it's gonna be interesting. My last scene was in that same sequence with the fight, the big fight, the climax of the movie, you might say. And it was when Walker says, "Ever had your ass kicked by a 12-year-old nerd with an inhaler?" And it just, again, with the snarky quips, it totally fits and works. But the whole sequence with him, like, finding Ryan Reynolds' character's light stick weapon.
It's a lightsaber.
It's not a lightsaber. It functions somewhat like a lightsaber, but it's not also not a lightsaber. But, like, he finds it, and he, like, gets really excited and is like, oh, yeah, like, here we go. And he, like, just starts using it, and he's really great at it, and it just reminded me of, like, Percy meeting Riptide, and he picks up this weapon, and it's basically like, whoa, like, this feels right, you know? I can totally see that whole sequence kind of coming alive in the show, so.
Yeah.
It was another moment where I was like, ooh, that's so Percy, like, that,
It's so funny. This movie is worlds away from Percy Jackson. It truly is. But there are elements of it that you can just see why they chose Walker. And that makes me so excited.
Oh, yeah.
I wanted to talk about a couple of moments from The Lightning Thief that we're looking forward to seeing Walker act out. I think we've already talked about it a bunch, but definitely the sarcasm with Clarice and Ares. The diner scene is going to be great. It's going to be so funny.
Oh, yeah.
And I think capture the flag again. I talked about running through the woods and everything. Annabeth using him as bait and him being mad about it is going to be hilarious. This is where I'm really excited to see who Annabeth's going to be and how she's going to portray the character, because the two of them riffing off of each other could be comedy gold.
Well, and the whole sequence with him stepping back into the water and finding out who his godly parent is, like, that I can almost see Walker doing half of that. Like, I can see it unfolding on screen in my head. And that, I can just hear the banter. Like,
yeah.
I don't know what they're saying, but I can, like, see them trading snaps back at each other. So, yeah, it's going to be great.
And then shipping the head back to Olympus. I mean, right? Like, so
he's going to have
it's gonna so be much fun. So great.
Putting fake stamps on a package. Like, here you go. Try this, Olympus. Yeah, no, I added a couple of moments to this, too. The St. Louis Arc fight stands out to me for some reason. I don't know why that one, considering there's a couple of, like, pretty big action sequences in that book. That one, maybe it's because we didn't get to see it in the movies that shall not be watched, as Rick calls them. Maybe it's because we didn't get to see that sequence, and it is so vivid and, like, interesting that I'm intrigued to see how it works, but I feel like Percy, especially kind of being alone and outnumbered in that, I can just, again, I can hear his mouth running the whole time as he's, like, trying to calculate how to get out of this situation, how to not die, and, like, I can totally see it. So I'm looking forward to that. And then lastly, the scene where Percy learns Chiron is a centaur and Grover is a satyr. I can't wait, guys.
Yeah. Right, because he learns Grover's a satyr in the car, and everything's chaotic. Right. Like, oh, that's going to be so funny.
And then he, like, gets to camp, and Chiron is, like, walking around, and, like, the whole wheelchair to, you know, to centaur to horse thing. Yeah. Like, I can't wait, because it's going to be really funny. And, yeah. Yeah.
There were some moments in the Adam Project where I was really, especially the second time watching it, really watching Walker's face to see the emotions that he was, and like, he's very good at like the tiny things mm-hmm. that bring emotion to the forefront of his performance. This kid is a good actor already. I mean, he's 13 years old, but he was going toe-to-toe with Ryan Reynolds and sometimes outshining him, and that is not easy.
No, it's not.
Especially in a comedy.
Well, and then when you add in the... I mean, Catherine Keener is no joke. We've already talked about her, but you've got Mark Ruffalo and you've got Zoe Saldana, both of whom are very seasoned, mm-hmm. talented actors, and he just holds it up. Like, yeah. He's right there with them, and I really loved it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think this movie also proves that he can do pretty much anything. He was doing the comedy. He was doing the deep emotional stuff. He was sad. He was mad. He was doing action sequences. Like, it really had a little bit of everything. If you're going to put a movie on your, you know, actor reel, like, this is right. a good one to put on there. Not it that is. He needs it. I think he's going to be set for a while. With Percy Jackson and all this other stuff coming up. So he's already making a splash. So we're obviously very excited about this.
As if you can't tell.
Yeah, it's going to be a really good time. Well, I mean, that pretty much wraps up the Adam Project. We did promise that maybe this episode would be a little quicker. We're not out of the woods yet, but I feel like that was a good discussion of what Walker brought to the table with the Adam Project and why we're excited about Percy Jackson and him being in the titular role.
And if you watch The Adam Project in the near-ish future and see anything we missed, any fun moments or any qualities that mm-hmm. shine through that we may have, like, skipped over talking about, feel free to reach out to us because we'd love to hear your thoughts as well.
And I saw somebody did an edit of the GIF where he presses the button and looks up at the ship above him, and they basically did like the scene from when he was claimed, and it was like, you know, Percy Jackson, son of the sea god, or whatever. Yeah. And like, it fit so perfectly, like the coloring and the look on his face, like you could just see that it could have been straight from the TV show. And if there are any other moments like that in the movie where you can like spin the edit, I love seeing that sort of thing. So
yeah,
hopefully we'll get a lot more.
I don't know. Yeah, like put Riptide in his head or something. Come on, there's got to be a scene, right?
I'm curious, too, because Secret Headquarters comes out in August, so there might be more stuff that could come out of that, and maybe we'll see that movie and talk about that as well. So
it's possible.
We'll just have to see. But for now, let's get back to Titan's Curse.
Yes.
And some stuff's happening.
Yeah, we read chapters 15 and 16 this week, so we will start with chapter 15, as always. And it is entitled, I Wrestle Santa's Evil Twin.
Pretty accurate.
Yeah. And I will say, I think these recaps are slightly shorter than
they
last
are,
time.
They are. I can tell.
They're still long. I looked back this... I've been doing the quotes for making some quote graphics for Lightning Thief Week and Sea of Monsters Week. And going back and looking at our quotes to kind of see if there were any I wanted to use. And I saw my first couple, like, brief recaps. And they're a little briefer. And I was like, man... Those were the days, like, when the chapters were only, like, 10 pages and I could get it done in, like, 5-6 sentences.
We haven't had a short chapter in a while.
Not since Sea of Monsters, I swear. Yeah. Like, we had a couple of really quick chapters in Sea of Monsters, and ever since, they've been quite long. Okay, here we go. Brief recap. The metal-winged statues fly our heroes at lightning speed all the way to San Francisco. Zoe hit every Target store sign they spotted along the way with an arrow, while Grover played his pan flute and Talia kept her eyes firmly closed tight. Upon landing, they head off to find Nereus and figure out what this creature is that Artemis was hunting. Percy finds and captures Nereus, holding tight from human to seal to eel and back again, who is excited to tell Percy the monster they search for is right there, points at their feet. He then dives back into the ocean, escaping, leaving our troop confused. Turns out Bessie is the monster they've been looking for. He is an Ophiuchorus, and if he were sacrificed and his entrails burned, the person responsible would have unimaginable power over the Olympian gods. It is right about the moment they figure this out that Dr. Thorne and a small host of guards enter the scene. Thorne tries to convince Talia to seize power at her fingertips, kill the Ophiuchorus, and fulfill the prophecy. She seems fuzzy? They escape Thorne, and Percy Iris messages Camp Half-Blood looking for Chiron. Mr. D answers and seems uninterested in helping, but soon, after Percy formally asks, Mr. D saves the day, and they learn where they need to go. Zoe's home, the garden of her sisters.
So Chuck and Hank are pretty funny. I think I like them a lot.
Yeah, I love Chuck and Hank. Honestly, the whole, I wish I could have done better justice the whole flight thing,
yeah.
Because I loved the little details that we did get of, you know, Percy letting his toes skim
the mountaintops,
like, the mountaintop, yeah. It's like stuff like that. It's, yeah, it's very cute and fun, and like Talia keeping her eyes closed and Percy like telling her like, you're fine, like, it's, you know, trying to help her not be terrified, and she's just like, we're going hundreds of miles an hour and we're flying and I have no interest in any of this, like, yeah. Just basically tell me when it's over.
I love that you put in here, Grover is tooting away on his flute. The word tooting just makes me laugh. I'm sorry, I'm a 12-year-old boy.
A 12-year-old boy, I was going to say. It's fine.
Yeah. But my question was, does the mist cover up their disappearance from the dam? Like, the statues are not at the dam anymore.
Yeah, I kind of was wondering that too. There's some weird misty things going on here, because when they land in San Francisco, there's a homeless guy who sees them for exactly what they are, like, mm-hmm. winged statues. And I was like, wouldn't the mist kind of cover that up? Like, make it look like a helicopter?
He could see through the mist,
right.
Which is a possibility.
It is, because we just saw that with Rachel Elizabeth, yeah. There in the last chapter. So it kind of, there are some weird misty things going on, and mm-hmm. So I wondered if maybe there was or was not something going on there,
yeah.
Yet. Like, the statues look fine at the dam, even though they're gone. The mist kind of covers up their absence.
Or it could be, like, under construction.
Right.
That's probably something the mist would do.
Probably.
Say, it's under construction. You can't touch their
feet
anymore.
Right, there's a tarp up, and there's, yeah. You can't get to them.
Speaking of the mist, though, Sally Jackson can see through the mist, which is, like, not surprising, and not something I haven't thought of before, but at the same time, I was like, oh, yeah, she's very similar to Rachel Elizabeth Dare in that she can see through the mist pretty easily. And I don't think we ever really think about it that way, because part of my brain assumed that because she had Percy, because she was with Poseidon, she just knows, and therefore the mist doesn't really affect her, but she is a special mortal,
yeah.
Which is kind of cool.
And I think that because she's Percy's mom, we kind of take for granted that she can see through it. Mm-hmm. We just kind of assume she can, you know? But you're right. Like, it is kind of a remarkable thing that even with a demigod son, she can see through the mist as a human. And, yeah, definitely. I love that it makes Percy kind of think back, like, could she see that Tyson was a Cyclops? Like,
yeah.
She probably knew before I did. Like,
yeah.
Why didn't she say anything? She probably assumed I noticed, you know? Like, stuff like that. I appreciated all of those moments.
Yeah. I also loved that he was like, Rachel Elizabeth Dare is so annoying. And I'm like, just you wait. Just you wait. You're going to find her even more annoying soon.
Right?
But we love her, so
get over it.
Yeah.
more Rachel Elizabeth Dare. We'll get there. Okay, so yeah, they land in San Francisco, and they quickly make their way to the waterfront so that they can find Nereus, because mm-hmm. Percy forgets, thank
yeah.
goodness for Grover, that Nereus is who they need to find so that they can get some answers. And I found it interesting, the whole, like, this is how Nereus works. You have to, like, catch him, hold on to him, and you get one question, and then he jumps back,
yeah.
You know, jumps back in the water and escapes. You know, not exactly efficient, but whatever. You get it, you get it.
I feel like he's like a leprechaun. Like,
right?
a little bit? Fish leprechaun. Something like that.
Yeah.
You gotta catch him, and then you get, like, one wish. Basically.
Yeah.
And then he
darts away.
Nereus was pretty interesting. I like that Percy tricked him by being like, oh no, not the water.
Right? And they're in the water and then it's like, haha,
yeah.
I got you. And I love him describing, like, Nereus being slippery and like, he turns into a seal, and Percy's like, you know, like, I've heard people talk about, I think it's...
Greased pigs.
A greased pig, yeah. I was going to say, he makes the comparison to a greased pig. He's like, I've heard people say that it's hard to hold on to, you know, just try holding on to a seal, because this is ridiculous.
I'm sure that would be difficult.
Right? And an eel? Like, ugh. And then he tries to knot him up as an eel, like, tie him into a pretzel, and Nereus figures it out and jumps out and is like, why are you harassing me, you annoying child? Yeah, so... What we learn from Nereus is that the monster's been there all along.
Aw, Bessie.
Bessie.
Ophiotaurus. I don't think I ever remember, like, obviously I've seen that name before because I've read this book before, but, like, not something that stuck in my head.
I think I remember it because I listened to the audiobook, and the word Ophiotaurus, I think, just, like, is one of those words, because as soon as they said it, I was like, oh, that's right! I remember so much about the Ophiotaurus now! Like, I forgot that that's what Bessie is. And yeah, so...
Bessie's also a boy.
Right.
There's so many misgendering of animals and creatures.
The first time I wrote the recap, I wrote it as Bessie was a girl.
Yeah.
Like, not thinking. And then, like, in the second chapter we read this week, I was in the middle of reading a sentence or something, and I saw Grover refer to Bessie as a boy, and I was like, uh-oh, I should check that. Went back, changed a whole bunch of stuff. I was like, dang it. How did I miss that? So, yes, Bessie is a boy.
Yeah. I stand by my love for Bessie.
Yes.
And a very innocent creature.
I'm so glad I now remember why Bessie is important. Yes. And very important. And,
oh, yeah.
And must be protected. Must definitely be protected.
So before we get into, you know, the sacrificing and Talia and all of that, I just wanted to mention really quickly, like, Dr. Thorne shows up, basically, and he says the gods banished him to Persia, and I was like, I wonder, and I found this very interesting. I googled, like, manticore, and manticores are of Persian origin, and so I thought it was a really interesting way that Rick blended those things together, and manticores came into the European continent via Greece and one of the, like, historians or philosophers or something like that. And that's how all of that kind of got mixed up together. And I was just like, that's so interesting that he's like, yeah, I was banished to Persia, and that's why manticores are of Persian origin. And it was just very clever.
Yeah.
I had to point that out and give Rick those, props.
Yeah, I was going to say, one of those tiny Rick moments where you're like, oh, you did so good. Like, that's so cool, and I love that you included that, because, you know, he could have just glossed over it.
Yeah.
Rick doesn't do that.
No.
He never does that. He always gives us the little details. Yeah. I love it. Okay. So, yes, that we quickly learn why the Ophiotaurus is important and all of the things that go along with that. And then Thorne shows up and basically, okay, this is definitely something we need to talk about. Because Talia kind of, Percy seems to think that maybe she's hesitating a little bit. But when he looks at her, he kind of describes her as being, like, in a bit of a daze. Like, mm-hmm. She seems kind of fuzzy, even as Thorne is trying to talk her into doing what he wants her to do. Like, she doesn't seem like she's entirely present to make a choice. And Percy's, like, trying to, you know, get her to say, like, no, of course I'm not going to do that. And, like, you know, he's kind of, like, poking her that way, where Thorne is using his words to kind of enchant her or something. I don't know.
Yeah, that was the part that I was wondering, because I kind of thought maybe it's a trick of Kronos. Like, whether or not he was using Thorne, Kronos has this ability to manipulate people. We've seen it with Luke, and even though, that's the thing, there has to be some truth in that, because Luke, while I think Kronos is taking advantage of Luke and manipulating him, he's also doing it because Luke already feels that way about the Olympian gods.
Yeah.
And Talia kind of does too, to a lesser extent, I think, but there is some truth in that. And especially in the next chapter with the lightning bolt, you kind of see that even though she's not in that daze anymore, she still feels angry about this. So I think it was Mr. D mentioned something about, like, was it Mr. D or Thorne? I don't know. Somebody mentioned something about Talia loving the idea of power and being powerful.
I think it's Mr. D.
Yeah, and he kind of calls her out on that. And I was like, okay, so how much of it was her just, like, thinking this through and being in a daze of her own creation versus a manipulation from somebody else, either Thorne or Kronos.
I definitely was under the impression that Thorne was kind of weaving some sort of magic or some sort of influence over her. But you're absolutely right that she is kind of halfway between where Annabeth was standing and where Luke was standing. Like, she's firmly, you know, Annabeth is her friend and Percy is her friend, and she doesn't, you know, want to do things that are going to hurt them and hurt their Olympian parents and all of that. But at the same time, like, she's pissed at Zeus because he's not doing what he, you know, what she wants him to do. And he's, you know, not been the greatest dad. And
he turned her into a tree. And right. He saved her life in doing that. But also, like, that sucks.
He left her as a tree.
Yeah.
He didn't come up with another solution or, you know, give it any thought either. He just left her as a tree. And Kronos is the one who ultimately saved her, if I'm not mistaken, you know, not mistaken.
Yeah, he brought her back.
Because Luke, it was through Luke that she came back. So it's like, I can see why she would be tempted and why she would consider her options and would look at, you know, what does this mean for me and for my other demigod, you know, friends? What would it mean if I were to do this? And so I don't blame her for taking a second, but I do think there was some sort of voodoo-y thing going on here. Something else was going on, not just her considering her options.
Yeah.
All right, and then gets us to Mr. D.
Yeah.
Because they find out about Bessie and Mr. Thorne shows up and Dr. Thorne shows up and, you know, Talia goes through this whole thing and then Percy, Iris messages Mr. D because they definitely are in need of help and he's looking for Chiron. He's mm-hmm. hoping for Chiron's help and he doesn't get it because Mr. D is there and is being his Mr. D self.
Yeah. He's, I really, see, this is what reminds me about how much I love Mr. D, because he's so funny, and, like, he's totally being a pain in the ass. Like, I get that. He wants his pizza, he doesn't really want to help them, but at the same time, like, part of me is also like, I don't think he was being a pain in the ass, because I think Percy had to ask him for help in order to receive it. He is a god, after all, so, like, you had to pray and ask for help from this god. And your whole point here too is like, I think Mr. D is a little gruffer on the outside than he actually is on the inside.
I definitely agree with you. Like, maybe he formally did have to request help from this god in order to receive it. Makes total sense. But Mr. D, of course, would make it as beneficial to himself as he possibly could. Because he accidentally calls Percy by the correct name. And Percy points it out and is like, after Mr. D saves the day, of course, he's like, you used my name, like my right, correct name. And he's like, what are you talking about, Peter Johnson? Get going. Like, Mr. D knows his name. And he's playing a role just like everybody else, and it's very interesting. Yeah.
I think that it's just who he is, and while he might have some affection for some of the campers, he can't really, like, he has to keep putting on that air of not caring. Probably makes life a little easier for him too. And I think he genuinely doesn't love being the head of this camp. But he's also not, you know, a bad person by any means, so.
Well, and he's a god, and the gods have always been kind of, like, uninterested in the affairs of mortals. And more interested in themselves. So he does kind of fit a little of both. Like, he has to know and understand more of what's going on here because he's stuck on Earth. But at the same time, he's still a god. So it makes sense that he's kind of, like, half interested. Okay, and that pretty much wraps up the chapter. We get a conversation with Zoe right at the end there where she talks about, I have to go home and to the garden of her sisters in order to save Annabeth and Artemis and everybody. So we know where we're going now, where we're going next, and we will get to that in a moment when we talk about chapter 16. But first, we have to do our favorite quotes. Karen, do you want to go first?
Yeah, mine's when he does the Iris message, and then, like, Mr. D's being a pain, and he's like, you're not even going to say hello to me? Like, how rude. And he goes, hello, we're about to die. Where's Chiron? And was just so funny.
Another line I can see Walker exactly. nailing. Like, that's going to be fine. Mine also comes from the Iris message moments, because how could it not? And Percy says, "You called me by my right name. You called me Percy Jackson." And Mr. D says, "I most certainly did not, Peter Johnson. Now off with you." I'm like, yes, please. You know who would make a decent Mr. D?
Who?
Mark Ruffalo.
Really?
He'd be fun. I can kind of see him, like, looking at him.
I feel like I could see him as Mr. Brunner, actually. Because, oh, yeah? Just because he's got that, like, professory kind of air about Maybe. Him.
Yeah, for sure.
I think he could do either, honestly.
I'm still stuck
on Stanley Tucci. I still want him to be
We Mr. all love D. Stanley Tucci in all the things.
Yeah.
Okay, and then our favorite moments. Karen, what was yours?
Basically, Mr. D making everyone go mad, saving Percy Jackson. I mean, Peter Johnson. Like you said, we didn't really talk about it specifically, but him... Like, because of Bacchanalia and Bacchus and all of that, like, and wine, and his followers used to kind of go into this euphoric state of madness. That's one of his powers, is to be able to do that to his enemies and have, like, the grapevines and stuff. And it was just, like, a really cool scene and, like, again, something very cinematic that I could see playing out on screen.
Definitely. Definitely. Mine was Talia's hesitation and this weird moment that is kind of undefined, but also... interesting. It's realistic, as we kind of talked about, like, considering all she's gone through and Zeus's treatment and Luke's arguments and her kind of being torn between her best friends, Luke and Annabeth. So I just really liked that we had a bit of that moment, and it informs us more of who Talia is. Like, we're still getting to know Talia. We still don't know everything about her, and I think this is an interesting moment for her character, and I will definitely get more and more as the book continues. So, mm-hmm. Okay, let's jump into chapter 16. We meet the dragon of eternal bad breath. Traveling with the Ophiotaurus proves difficult. Grover has the bright idea to take Ophi back to Camp Half-Blood, where Chiron can help them get him to safekeeping in Olympus. With Grover as Ophi's guide, the blessing of the wild for safe passage, and some help from Poseidon, after Percy sacrifices the Nemean lionskin, they might just make it. That takes care of Ophi, but now they need to get to Zoe's sister's garden. And who better to ask for help but Annabeth's father? They show up at his doorstep, and after some snacks and chatting, he lends them his Volkswagen to get them over the Golden Gate and up the mountain before sundown. Talia senses danger and orders Zoe to stop driving and everyone out of the car right before a lightning bolt totals the classic. They enter the garden, and it's exactly what Percy saw in his dream, the one where Zoe created Riptide. She faces her sisters, outsmarts Laden the dragon, and they all make it further up the mountain. Mount Othiris, that is, the mountain fortress of the Titans, and the home of Atlas, where he holds up the sky. They make it to the summit and find Artemis in Atlas's place, and struggling in pain. The general, aka Atlas himself, is there, along with Luke, and of course, Annabeth, restrained and gagged behind him. And that is where we learn the general is none other than Zoe's father. Dun, dun, dun!
That was very good. Very dramatic. Right?
It is. It's super dramatic. A lot happened in this chapter.
We keep saying that every week.
I mean, the first chapter... there was some stuff, but it wasn't so packed. This, I feel like, is another one of those that has a lot of little things that you kind of have to talk about.
A lot of, like, coming to fruition, too, and, like, things have been leading up to this. We are getting to the final chapters of the book, so everything's about to go crazy.
Exactly, yeah. One of the things that I actually put in the wrong chapter, at first, was that Percy figures out Zoe's hero's identity.
Mm-hmm. We put it together last week.
Yeah, we did. Good, go us.
Yeah.
But yeah, as he's sacrificing the Nemean lionskin and, you know, giving Grover and Bessie safe passage, he kind of puts together that her hero was Hercules, and that's kind of huge. And, like, it's not that it changes anything or that it's, you know, but I think it's just important to kind of, for Percy to keep in mind, like, Zoe was instrumental in Hercules being the hero he is, mm-hmm. and she gets zero credit, and, like...
she was wiped from history.
Yeah, and her family has written her off and all of that. So it's just a moment, like, as he makes the realization to kind of, like, keep in mind that she's got a lot of stuff that nobody really knows about because it happened so long ago.
Right. The bigger thing for me here was him sacrificing the Nemean lion coat. Like, that was a really big deal. And I mean, that goes to show how important it was to get Bessie back to camp and everything. But that's tough because that could literally save your life. And you're going up against some pretty scary people. So,
I mean, it's already saved his life like 4 or 5 times on the journey. And they're about to go into the biggest battle ever. And he's willing to give it up. And that says something. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so then Grover volunteers to play Bessie's guide back to camp.
That was kind of funny.
It is. The whole thing, like, as they're sinking into the water, and Grover's like, I can't breathe down here. Like, please. And Percy's like, hopefully Poseidon's help extends to, like, an air bubble.
And then he just turns around and they keep going, like, you know, can't worry about that now.
Right? Like, it's already handled and done, so Poseidon will take care of it.
Hope I get to see my best friend later.
Right? Or maybe Bessie will just surface often enough.
Yeah.
Grover. Grover. But yeah, so they're on their way, and Grover is no longer in the party at the moment. So we can kind of, for the moment, he might be safe. Might be.
Or he could be drowning.
Or you never know. One of the two. So then they go to find Annabeth's dad because they need some help. They basically need a car or something to get them to the mountain in time, because otherwise there's no chance that they're going to make it in time to save anyone. So they meet Annabeth's dad. They basically show up on his doorstep and knock and say, hey, we need your help. It's for your daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And so they get a chance to meet Annabeth's dad, and they see her brothers playing, and they meet her stepmom, who is, you know, ready and willing with sandwiches and cookies and soda. And, you know, they find her dad is very kind of dotty and history obsessed, and has a giant model built of a battle that he's working on, you know, a book for or whatever. It's so, honestly, he's not that far off from what I would picture for Annabeth's dad. Like, if you didn't know anything about Annabeth or anything about her parents, you knew that one was Athena and the other was a human. Like, I would kind of picture somebody kind of like this, obsessed with whatever they're most obsessed with, whether it's architecture or history or something. But I loved how Rick created, like, how the character of her father kind of is. I love it.
It's so interesting because we've been building to this since book one, when we found out that she did not have a good relationship with her dad, and she's slowly been trying to rectify that. And in my mind, you know, I never really liked him because she had a strained relationship, and the way that she perceives him is the way that we perceive him. And then you come to meet him and you're like, oh, like, I can totally see the issues that she has with him.
Yeah.
And I get that. But at the same time, like, there's no malice there. It's just the kind of person he is. So it's a little bit easier to forgive him for some of those things. First of all, I forgot that I knew she had a brother. I forgot that they were twins. So that was like, oh yeah, that's cool. And the chases themselves seem chaotic and imperfect, but loving. And I literally cried when Mrs. Chase said, Annabeth still has a home here. And I think that's so cool because a lot of times you see stepmothers portrayed as villains and as evil, or they hate their stepchildren. And it's really cool that he remarried and had kids, and they have this family that, again, is imperfect, but, like, normal. Like, it felt so normal.
Yeah.
And I really love that.
As we're sitting here discussing it and thinking about this and thinking about Annabeth and how she relates to her dad, it kind of becomes clear. As a child of Athena and someone who's so strategic and thinking about all, you know, thinking long term, looking at the, you know, the consequences of things and that sort of stuff, I can see why maybe Annabeth has issues with her dad.
Yeah,
he's totally so dotty. You know, he's so focused on his work and doesn't really have a lot of room for everything else. You know, when he answers the door, he thinks that these planes that he's waiting on for this model are there. Like, he's 100% focused on what's going on in his world.
Mm-hmm.
So I can see why him being so, like, scattered might drive her away from him a little
bit. Yeah.
Despite the fact that he's a really, you know, loving, sweet guy, it's just, he's not.
It's funny how two people can be very similar in that they're both hyper-focused on the things they're passionate about, and yet very different in the way that they approach those things. You're right, Annabeth is very almost militaristic, which makes sense because Athena is her mother, mm-hmm. in the way that she is dedicated to strategy and to architecture and wanting to, you know, how she sees her future and how she attacks her future versus him, where he's just like gets so easily distracted. I mean, they told him that his daughter was in danger and he gets excited about planes, like, and it's not because he doesn't care, it's just he literally forgot for a second that yeah. like they were there for something very important, and he got wrapped up in his own passion in a very different way. So I think that's a really, really good point that, of course, you know, the way that her father leads his life is going to bother Annabeth a little bit because it's so different from the way she leads hers.
And yet, at the same time, I can see why Athena would have been drawn to someone yeah. like that, because, A, he shares her passion for history and war, and, you know, he finds all those things fascinating, but at the same time, he's a bit of a departure from yeah. her very structured, strategic brain. Like, I can see why she would have been tempted toward him, to be attracted mm-hmm. to him, and to, you know, have Annabeth. Like, I can definitely see the allure between the two of them.
Yeah, I feel like he would remind her to, like, relax and go with the flow every once in a while, and she's, like, not used to that. That could be cool.
Well, and, like, you can see him drawing Athena into, like, a geek-out session over some battle that she fought or something. Yeah. Like, him going, like, this is so cool, and I can't believe that you blah, blah, you know? Like, I can totally see it. Like, that, I can see that being an appealing thing for a god when you're looking at a mortal. Like, yeah. I can definitely see the qualities. Okay, so then we leave Annabeth's dad's house. He loans them his Volkswagen Bug, and they are headed up the mountain. I don't know why. I don't remember if the bug is described as being yellow. I think it is. Because I picture it, like, lemon yellow yeah. for some reason. And they're driving up the mountain, and all of a sudden, you know, Talia freaks out and yells, "Everybody out!" Mm-hmm. Like, Zoe, stop! Everybody out of the car.
Doesn't Percy do it first? Like, doesn't he recognize?
I think he, like, feels something.
He feels
changed.
Something's wrong. Yeah, because yeah. I thought it was really interesting that he also kind of all of a sudden knew something yeah. was, like, not right.
Something in the air changed when she told Zoe to stop the car first, and then all of a sudden she's screaming, "Get out! Get out! Get out!" And they all barely make it out in time. I'm pretty sure Talia drags Percy out, because he's not, like, moving fast enough, if I do recall. Because she kind of saves his life there.
She uses the shield to...
Oh, yeah, that's yeah, it.
From the scraps.
She kind of saves his life. Yeah, just mm-hmm. a little bit. But, yeah, definitely appears to be a thunderbolt from Zeus.
Yeah, not the right move.
I mean, Percy tries to convince her that it was Kronos, not Zeus, and that Kronos is trying to manipulate her to hate her father. And while that's, you know, totally possible, I don't know, man.
I mean, I honestly don't remember what this was like, but my instinct is telling me that Zeus got worried Talia would turn on them, and so he tried to take her out first, which is, like, not the right move when your daughter's on the fence about which way she's gonna sway.
Yeah.
Like, it was... Again, I think Zeus is very impulsive in his own way, and he's just like, well, I'm going to solve this problem once and for all. And, you know, we're supposed to believe that he cares about his children, and I think he does, but obviously is also willing to sacrifice them. And maybe that's not what's going on here, but if it is, he's got some explaining to do.
Yeah, for sure. This whole moment... I picked part of this as part of this moment is my favorite quote, so I kind of want to hold off on it. But yeah, there's definitely some interesting dynamic going on here, especially because he waits this long to kill her and take yeah. her out when, you know, the back at the water's edge is where her real hesitation happened, and ever since she's been fully on board Operation Save Everyone. Mm-hmm. So, like, why now is he like, oh, okay, here's my shot? Like, it just kind of feels off.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Also, was he gonna kill Zoe and Percy at the same time?
He seemed totally open to the idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. As long as the Ophiotaurus isn't in there, you know, maybe that had something to do with it. I don't know. Anyway, Zoe is really good at, well, everything. Basically, from the moment they get on the mountain, she sneaks them through the mist into the garden to see her siblings. And she, you know, her siblings are all like, yeah, there are only four of us. You are definitely not one of us. Like, you know, we kicked you out years ago and you're a hunter and blah, blah, blah. So, but like, Zoe just moment to moment here is just getting things done. Whether it's waking up Layden, despite her, you know, against her sister's wishes, but she feels like she can control him enough to use him for her advantage. So she wakes him up and she sends Talia and Percy running up the mountain. And, you know, she says, I've got this. Like, I can distract him long enough to, you know, get you guys up to where you need to be. And they escape. And they keep moving on up the mountain and finally to this last altercation where we learn that not only is this vision that Percy had early in the book was actually Annabeth holding up the sky at one point, and now Artemis has taken that role. And we all know who's supposed to be there. It's Atlas, who we quickly learn is the general and also Zoe's father.
Yeah.
Kind of a lot of blanks filled in really, really fast.
Yeah, definitely. This came to me in a moment, like a lightning strike moment back when we were reading, when we first met him. And I was like, oh, I think that might be Atlas. And I didn't want to say it because I didn't want to ruin it.
I definitely
but forgot. But it definitely, everything kind of slotted into place. And I was so happy that I was right because it was half a guess. I mean, I didn't actually remember. But I think this is really cool, and I think I definitely remember Atlas being involved in the story at some point and him not being the nicest guy in the world, and this whole, like, holding up the sky thing in the cavern, you know, the way that Percy finally puts it together is super interesting, and Artemis, you know, a goddess struggling to hold up the world is a very interesting visual. And again, goes back to this idea of what can hurt the gods? What makes them weak? How do they react to certain things that, you know, are outside their own realms? And I think this just goes to prove that they can suffer like we suffer in a lot of ways.
Yeah. I also love how even in a moment where Annabeth has, like, zero way of communicating, she's still communicating with Percy, and the message she's trying to get across is run.
Yeah.
Like, no,
that
you can't help me here, go.
That moment where they finally see each other. I mean, she disappeared in, what, the first or second chapter of the book?
It's like she the has first been, scene,
yeah,
you know, like the first major scene.
She's been gone this entire time, and their eyes connect again. And I was just like, oh, like, I felt that reunion. I felt, like, a real emotional connection between them. And it must have been such a relief for her to see them arrive. I mean, she's also going, please don't be here because you're going to be in as much trouble as I am. But she must have finally been like, oh my God, they didn't forget about me.
Yeah. I mean, we all know that there's no way Percy's going to forget about Annabeth. Yeah. But, you know,
I think she knows that too, but it must also still just be nice to see them show up.
Yeah, heck yeah. No, and especially, she obviously knew when Artemis showed up that Artemis was kind of MIA as well. So, like, I can see her kind of saying, like, are they even looking for me? Yeah. You know, are they all hunting for Artemis? Did everybody forget about me? And while she may not have been Zoe's priority, she was definitely Percy's priority. Yeah. So, you know.
And I would say Talia's, too.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Absolutely. Okay, so that wraps up this chapter, and we'll pick up at the end of this, you know, for the next one. Nothing like ending it in a, you know, bit of a cliffhanger for Rick.
Seriously.
He loves doing that. So, yeah, we'll pick that up next time. But let's do our favorite moments and quotes. We'll start with quotes. Mine was Talia, after Zeus strikes the lightning bolt, strikes the car with the lightning bolt, she says, "One shall perish by a parent's hand. Curse him. He would destroy me." Me? And just the energy in this is so, like, so perfectly Talia. And it's like, I love that she's always got the prophecy, like, on the tip of her tongue, like, one shall perish by a parent's hand. Like, she's thinking, okay, so I'm the one. You're gonna do this here right now.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. All right, buddy. Like, we'll see about that. Just, yeah.
I'm so mad at Zeus.
Yeah, such a moment. And I loved that moment for Talia and for what it kind of opens her eyes a little bit there. But, yeah, it's Zeus, dang it. Karen, what was yours?
Mine was a silly line from Zoe. She says, "Believe me, if you had dragon breath, you would chew eucalyptus too." And I just...
It's a good one.
It was so funny.
That was with the lozenges, I think. Percy was thinking, like...
He never wants to have cough drops again because they smell like eucalyptus.
Right? I mean, I get it. Although, you're the one who doesn't like eucalyptus.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan. Not the biggest fan.
I love it. Anyway, moving on. Favorite moments. Mine was Annabeth's father and her stepmother being so lovely and just not only to Percy and the crew showing up on their doorstep and feeding them and giving them what they need and sending them on their way, but just in general, really. I mean, we didn't know, we hadn't met them before, and all we knew is what Annabeth told us. So it's kind of nice to have a full picture, and I'd like to hear from Annabeth why these lovely people drive her so crazy. Because they do, and it's part of the reality of their situation. So I'm definitely interested to hear more from Annabeth in the future. What was your moment?
Mine was Zoe and the dragon. I just thought it was a very cinematic moment. I think that her trying to plead with the dragon, like, you remember me, I used to hand feed you and all that kind of stuff. And the way the dragon was described as like a pile of like spaghetti noodles with all these heads and stuff, I think that's going to look so cool on screen. And just her legitimately trying to distract the dragon while the other two get around it, and then finding a way past, getting hurt, but like, you know, eventually finding a way past. I just thought the whole sequence was really cool.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, no, I'm excited to see the dragon at some point. That's gonna be cool. Okay, so that wraps up chapter 16. Next week we'll be reading chapters 17 and 18, so give those a look, and we will talk about those next week. Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. Follow our website on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and Instagram at Subjectify Media, or visit us at SubjectifyMedia.com. We are home to 3 other podcasts, including Rewatchable, where we rewatch canceled and cult classic shows, Not About the Weather, which is a general interest show that sometimes features interviews with creators, and Not Another Teen Wolf podcast, which was recently revived thanks to the upcoming Teen Wolf movie. You can contact Prophecy Radio directly on Twitter at Prophecy Podcast or on Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr at Prophecy Radio Podcast. You can also email us your long-form thoughts to prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. You can find us on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms. Please consider leaving us a review or rating. 5-star ratings really help other people to find us, and that is always awesome. You can leave us comments and questions or ideas for things you might want to see, any of the above, anything that we've talked about on the episodes is fair game, so we'd love to hear from you. We did get some feedback this week, a couple of tweets, if I'm not mistaken. Karen, do you want to take the first one?
Yes. So Books and Pops 101, our friend at Laura Morrow 123 says, heavens, rereading Sea of Monsters with you all made me remember how much I adore Tyson. He is such a sweet character. I am excited to see him pop up again in the future. I feel the exact same way rereading the books. You know, I already knew I loved Tyson, but the little moments that you forget that are kind of lost to time after you've stepped away from the books for a while just really came out at me full force. And Tyson is such a great character, and we really wanted to highlight him during Sea of Monsters week, and that's why we did a couple of quotes and Kristen did some fun graphics for him because he's just the best. I just really love him.
We have a soft spot for Tyson. Yeah,
definitely.
In case that's not clear. Okay, and then our second one comes from Nicholas Haman at Haman Nicholas, who says, it impresses me how abundant, varied, and specific your castings get. The only Percy Jackson fan casts I've got at all are Cecily Strong as Hera and Mark Ruffalo as Nero. Everything else feels vague. Maybe more will come in the future.
Interesting thoughts.
I thought Cecily Strong was really interesting as Hera. I have somebody else that I feel very strongly about that we'll have to get to at some point. But thank you for this comment, because we really try very hard to think outside the box. And I think there are a few people that are like easy picks for some of these gods. And both of us kind of sit down and go, okay, who are other people not going to think of? Like,
right,
who's somebody out of left field that once you think about them, you're like, oh, that person would be really good.
Yeah. Somebody who doesn't necessarily fit either physically or maybe like skill-wise, like, we haven't seen them do a role right. like that, but it could be really cool if they, like, did it and aced it. Like, it would be so neat. Yeah.
And Kristen and I talk about movies so often. We're always talking about actors and, you know, where we like them from and all this other stuff that I feel like part of it comes a little bit naturally. Yeah. And part of it just, like, we sit down and really think, okay, what's going to be a weird pick for this one?
It's fun. It's lots of fun.
It is.
Also, I think Mark Ruffalo should just be in this series somewhere.
Like, somewhere.
He could play everybody.
Yeah. So. Just... I feel like there are actually a couple of roles that he would play very well.
I agree. He's a very talented guy. So, yeah, he could fit in a couple of places. At the very least, he could play Paul Blofus. Anyway, moving on.
I would like that, actually.
Right? He'd be fun. Anyway. But thank you again for reaching out, both of you, and everyone else who reached out this week. We are, you know, constantly on Twitter or whatever, so it's nice to hear from you guys and interact a little bit.
Definitely.
Next week, we will be doing a deep dive on Aries.
I'm really excited
for
this one.
It's going to be fun, yeah.
Because this one, we can play around a little bit more with, like, who's going to be, like, a tough guy character for this, and...
I feel like, ultimately, fan casting both Poseidon and Zeus, like, they kind of have a similar look. Like, they're different, but at the same time, you can kind of use the same visual to describe both of them in slightly different ways. But yeah, Aries is a different monster altogether.
Yeah.
Like, it's a whole different animal you're kind of looking at here.
He's very, like, you can picture him. He has the fire glowing in his, like, vacant eyes. He's in the biker garb. Like, you really get a visual of him from the books. And he's a bad guy. Like, Zeus isn't great, but, like, ultimately, he's still kind of a good guy. Whereas Ares, so far, has been a true antagonist of the books. So you can play a little bit around with what that's going to be like. And I am very excited to figure out who we're going to come up with for these fan castings.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be fun. It's going to be a good time. So, yeah, until next week, this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio, signing off. Over and out.